doing well, man. Thanks for coming on the Thank God for Bitcoin podcast.
Yeah, thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Well, Brandon, why don't you just give an introduction to our audience? I'm guessing there'll be a few people that know you or maybe that have seen you around Twitter, but for those who haven't, can you just kind of give an introduction to who you are and what you're doing?
Sure, yeah. Brandon McLean Smith. I always have to throw in my middle name since my name, there's about four or five Brandon Smiths in the sort of evangelical Christian world. But yeah, so I'm the archival editor for Westminster Magazine. That's one of the main things that I do. I graduated from Westminster in 2017.
Just to clarify, that's Westminster Theological Seminary.
Okay. Yep, Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, not to be confused with the various other Westminsters, Westminster, California. There's a couple, sure. I think, in the UK as well. But yeah, Westminster Theological Seminary. I graduated from the MDiv there in 2015 or 2017. I worked in various different positions there while I was in my MDiv. And then once I graduated, I had applied for some PhD programs and things like that. And I got accepted into one in Edinburgh, but didn't get funding. And then so I decided, okay, I'll work full time, try to save up some money, make that happen. And then COVID hit. And then I got married. And then I bought a house, and then I had a kid, and so life happened, and so PhD stuff is kind of on the back burner. So my main thing is working for the seminary for Westminster with the magazine. So
got you. And so just real quick, did you have a specific area of study that you wanted to, like a thesis that you wanted to do for your PhD? Did you already have that in mind? Or
yeah so I was hoping to do Herman Bobbink. That was going to be kind of my main thing, and that the initial dissertation topic that I'd come up with was relating to him and Thomas Aquinas and natural theology, natural law, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But you know, who knows how those things develop once you get into a program. Sometimes your thesis gets completely switched around. So who knows what it would have been, but that was what I had on my application at least. So
I mean, Bobbink there's been a Bobbinkissance the last few years. I think the person who I was introduced who really gave me the biggest introduction to him was Derek Rishmawi from the Mere Fidelity. All the rest of the guys in the podcast joke about him and his love of Bavink, but that's really cool. So we got connected on Twitter, of all places, and then we just kind of started talking about Austrian economics and Cornelius Van Til, and I mean, it just took this whole turn that I was not expecting. So can you just kind of talk a little bit through, and this is we're going to get to the meat and potatoes of this interview as far as kind of just the history of maybe Westminster and more like Reformed theology and sound money, some works by Mises and stuff like that. But kind of what is your history with Austrian economics? How did you come to think about and care about that topic?
Yeah. So it was kind of actually unrelated to my background in theology, or at least I thought that it was. I thought there's a little bit more relation than I realized. But and even in college, I became a Christian in college, and sort of at the same time, I graduated from college in 2012, and I came into college in 2008. So 2008 and 2012, what libertarian things happened? 2008, Ron Paul. I was kind of on the Ron Paul train, sort of. I wasn't reading much theory or anything like that.
Yeah.
But this guy sounds cool. So then, I get into seminary in 2012, and I was just kind of on the internet, following memes, and I got memed into Austrian economics, and so I just started listening to podcasts and reading more, getting into Murray Rothbard and Mises and Hans Hermann Hoppe. And so I just was reading that stuff, and I was listening to a ton of just libertarian podcasts, and they were, talking about the Austrian theory of the business cycle and all that, and sound money and the gold standard and all these things. And so I was reading a bunch of that stuff, and particularly I was reading a lot of Hans Hermann Hoppe. And at Westminster, Van Til is huge at Westminster Seminary. He was one of the founders and all that. And he, his most famous thing that he's known for is really his presuppositional transcendental critique, covenantal apologetics. And so it's the, you know, the transcendental argument for God. And so I'm reading Hans Hermann Hoppe, and I'm realizing he has this book called Argumentation Ethics, and it's essentially a transcendental argument for capitalism. Mm. And it's pretty technical stuff. I think I grasp it, but I think the idea is that he has is if you are making an argument for capitalism, you're essentially engaging in a free market because argument is non-coercive.
Yeah.
And so you're acknowledging that by having the argument about socialism, you're in favor of socialism, you're actually undermining your case and arguing for capitalism.
Yeah.
So I'm like, this sounds like Van Til, because Van Til makes a transcendental argument where he says, if you're engaging in an argument against God, you have to have some form of predication, and predication has to be founded on God. So you're essentially undermining your own argument. So I'm reading these two things side by side, and I'm like, man, Hoppe sounds a lot like Van Til.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if he's just familiar with the transcendental form of argument, because it goes back before Van Til, certainly. There could be some, it's not like he was reading Van Til. I doubt that. But when I was down in the archives, because, as part of my work as the archival editor of the magazine, is I'm in the Westminster Archives. And
yes. And this we got connected the other day. You told me about this find that you found. I just about lost my mind when you said this. So go ahead.
Well, when I saw it down there, I just about lost my mind, because I think I'm living in these two different parallel worlds of Austrian economics and Reformed theology. And then I'm down in the library looking at a bunch of Van Til's personal books that we have in the archival collection down there. And I see that he had a copy of Human Action by Ludwig von Mises. What? I'm freaking out. And I'm down there with our archivists, and, archivists are very prim and proper, and you can't don't touch anything,
don't breathe on it.
And so I'm like, wait, you gotta like open this and like go like, let me see some of these pages. And so he's kind of opening it, and he's like kind of folding through the pages, and I'm saying that he's got underlines and marginalia and unfortunately I was doing something I needed to I couldn't spend all day, but I need to get back in there and see like what he was doing with that stuff.
Yeah. So why don't you go ahead and tell everybody the question that I asked you shortly after you told me you found that book?
Yeah. Jordan here asked that. Hey, this might be a weird question, but can I buy that? And I was like,
I should have known, but I just figured I was like, I would hate myself if I didn't ask, because like,
I'm for it. Like, and the fact that you asked it just was like, respect, dude.
I know. Well, then I'm like, I mean, if anybody's gonna want this book, it's this guy. Like, we're sitting here both, geeking out over this thing. But no, honestly, like the free market, just, that line of thinking, I see it everywhere. I've got a book in the works that's kind of a sequel, spiritual, it almost is like a prequel, like a spiritual prequel to the book that we ended up writing, Thank God for Bitcoin. And a lot of it just is stemming from this idea of value and like what is value? What is money? What is it supposed to do? Yeah. And you have to keep going back. You end up getting to the point where you're like, well, how do I know, like, what is there objective value? And if there is, then where does it come from? And so basically my thesis is value is rooted, obviously, I mean, as a Christian, like, value is rooted in the person and in character of God. He comes down, when you get back to anything, what does it mean to be human? To be human is to be a steward. Paul, the Apostle Paul says, what do you have that you didn't receive? And so at the end of the day, we're called to be faithful with the whatever it is that God's given to us. That's what we are called to do, is just be, faithful with it. And God has created his own like store of value. And we could go on for a long time, but, God's store of value is people. If you go through the characteristics of money and the properties of money, you start to see, this has been kind of my road over the last 4 years that I've been, nerding out on this. There's a real sense in which people serve the same function to God that money serves for people, or at least that good money serves for people. So that whole world is just super fascinating to me. Just really, again, I'm sure that hopefully this won't be the last time, we... we hop on and talk about these things.
Yeah.
So the other thing that we started talking about, I had mentioned that I just recently interviewed Doug Wilson, and we were talking about during the Mexican-American War, there was a number of pastors who were very vocal proponents of free markets and just saw the implications and the effects that they have on everyday life and including the life of the church. One of the things that you had mentioned was that you had seen this at work other places. Can you speak to that a little bit? The history of pastors, specifically even in just the United States and in other places around the world, advocating for free market economics.
Yeah, for sure. And I think because a lot of it stems back from, it might be kind of a similar thing with like the sort of two parallel worlds that I thought that I was in that weren't. And especially, you know, my area of maybe expertise is putting it too strongly, but the area that I know the most is sort of Westminster and the founding of Westminster and the climate that it came out of.
Sure.
And then what they went on to do with like social stuff in terms of critiquing the culture and critiquing really the things that the government was doing and overstepping to the spheres of the church and of the family and all that. And a lot of it comes from the early 1900s, in the 1910s, you start to see the modernist controversy in the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. That starts brewing probably around the same time, Mexican-American War. It starts working itself out in other ways into the early 1900s. Machen writes a book, Christianity and Liberalism. Mm-hmm. And he's writing that against theological liberalism, modernism. There's a different ways that we can talk about that. But a lot of it is stemming from like German higher criticism, and they're starting to question things like the virgin birth and the deity of Christ, the historicity of Adam, and really all of Genesis. There's nothing that is not on the table for discussion. And so they're fighting against that, and they're fighting against this on a very theological level because they're seminary professors at Princeton. And you got guys like, you know, O.T. Alos and Robert Dick Wilson, who are Old Testament scholars, and they're talking about supernaturalism and the Old Testament and the historicity of Genesis and who's the author of Isaiah, these kind of questions. And Machen writes this book, Christianity and Liberalism, and that kind of really kicks things into high gear. And then Princeton Seminary, is reorganized. And it was kind of historically, Princeton was viewed and sort of built, metaphorically speaking, like a bulwark, like a castle, right? And it was the official seminary of the Presbyterian Church. And so the idea was that you would send people to this institution to be trained, and then they would go out and influence the church.
Yep.
So you'd have this good, robust, confessional, reformed education, and then they would go out. But then around this time, the organization of the seminary actually changes. And there's the board is rearranged, and they decide that rather than being a bulwark or a castle, it should be more like a mirror. And so what I mean by that is whatever is out in the church, it needs to be represented in the curriculum. Okay. So we have pastors who believe these things. And so it needs to be represented in the curriculum. And so Machen and some of the founders of who would go on to found Westminster said that's a recipe for disaster because it's going to be a feedback loop, right?
Yeah.
You get some weird education and then you go out, and then when you're in ministry, you get a little bit weirder. And so then that needs to be represented. And so the curriculum gets weirder, and then it just does that over and over.
100%. Yeah. It's like a degradative cycle. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. So essentially this, what was just kind of heady theological debates about, you know, the historicity of Isaiah and all this stuff. Well, now it's in the church.
Yeah.
And so these professors who are educators and theologians, they're also churchmen. And so they see this happening in the church. And so now they're having to realize, okay, this is bearing fruit.
Yes.
So I think some of the fruit that they're seeing is what's happening with like the social gospel with Woodrow Wilson and his sort of messianic view of himself. So they're realizing that this theological liberalism is spreading. And so when they start engaging in those things, that's when they start really talking about things like economics and education and social degradation, because it's affecting their congregants and it's affecting their churches. One of the things that is really interesting about that period is how much all of this sort of lines up with the Federal Reserve and the Jekyll Island conspiracy. I don't know if your listeners will know what that is.
This is catnip for Bitcoiners. So yeah, go ahead.
The Jekyll Island conspiracy, when they secretly form the Federal Reserve, that happens in 1913, which is around the same time that Machen, it's actually the same year that Machen writes an article called Christianity and Culture. Mm-hmm. And in that he's talking about education, how the education system is basically atheistic, right? Everything is completely separated. Theology doesn't influence anything. And Van Til talks about that later in his career. He critiques John Dewey, who's the Dewey Decimal System guy. That's how we know him. But really, he was also one of the founders of
godless
education system.
100%, yeah.
Yeah, and so that happens in 1913. And then 10 years later is when Machen writes Christianity and Liberalism, which is what kicks off really the big fight in the Presbyterian Church. And then in 1929, just 6 years after that, Machen is kicked out of Princeton. He's removed from his position there. So he founds Westminster to combat that. So that's 1929. What else happened in 1929? The Great Depression, right? The Federal Reserve's chickens come home to roost in the same year.
Yep.
And so then in 1933, is when he founds the OPC, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, because he was kicked out of Princeton first, and then he was actually fully kicked out of the denomination. The reason he was kicked out of the denomination is there was a missions board. The Presbyterian Church had this board of missionaries, and they would fund missionaries to go all over the world. And the board was basically funding missionaries like a woman named Pearl Buck. And she basically said the idea that we need to convert people to Christianity is a superstitious thing. Really, it just what we need to do is just kind of give material comfort, food, shelter, things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. And so Machen was like, absolutely not. So he said, what we're going to do is we're going to found an independent mission board so that people who want to give money to actual missionaries can give money to the independent board.
And that's that.
Yeah. We can send actual missionaries. And so he basically does that, and then they say, "Well, that's just a step too far. It's un-Presbyterian to do that." So they kick him out in 1933, and that's the same year that ownership of gold is outlawed in the United States.
Yeah, man, 1602.
Yep. So he talks about that. He has a really great quote where he's talking about just how insane it is that the government is just voiding independent contracts between consenting parties.
One of the things that you were mentioning in laying this out is that, contrary to what might be intuitive, these voices are much more, they fall down much more in the line of somebody like Ron Paul than they would, you know, some rhino neocon.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd have to do more research into this, but is not necessarily that they were so far outside of the norm, like, because Ron Paul is kind of, by a lot of people, he's not exactly representative of, he's kind of a radical.
Yeah.
But I think really it wasn't that they were these radicals. I think that's just what conservatives were back then.
Yeah.
Right. Like, conservatives just kind of were Ron Paul guys. And so when you read their social stuff, it's a lot of it is like, yeah, this can easily come from Ron. It's very anti-war.
Yeah.
It's very anti-government education. It's very anti government interference in economics and in the markets. It sounds like Machen and or it sounds like Ron Paul. Machen sounds like Ron Paul, and you also see them talking about how, and these are like, I'd have to see exactly when this was, but there's a quote that I remember seeing, probably from the 30s or 40s, where they were talking about how the conservatives of today are basically like the liberals of 20 years ago. And so that's just been something that's been happening. And you know, we see where it goes.
100%. I was talking with Doug Wilson, and one of the things he said is that progressives, like, they want to drive off the cliff at 80 miles an hour. And, you know, the Republicans want to drive off at a more conservative 55. It's just a few years later, you know, a little bit behind, but really they're going the same direction. As I've been thinking about this for, you know, a good number of years, and like trying to, like, translate between the it does end up being like the Austrian economic world, but more specifically translating between the monetary world and world described in the scriptures. What's stunning, again, is you think that these are two different things that might have some parallels or something, but there are way more intimate connections than you might ever imagine. And on one level, that ought to make sense. Jesus says you can't serve two masters. He says you're going to serve God or mammon. So it's just super interesting that of all the things, you know, Jesus compares, he's like, it's either going to be God or mammon. It's either going to be wealth or God. It's a rival source with the things that are laid out in scripture. One of the things specifically is sound money prioritizes and accepts, submits itself to, humbly acknowledges the principle of sowing and reaping. The Apostle Paul in Galatians goes so far as to say, God is not mocked, for what a man sows, that will he also reap. And so Paul basically says, God is so hardwired into the nature and design of the world that actions have consequences. To deny that is to mock God. You think of something like fiat currency. Fiat currency mocks God. Like, it effectively mocks God by saying, debt is just money we owe ourselves. You know, we can deficit spend with, and we can avoid the consequences. We can, you know, outrun the consequences. This isn't just, you know, not ideal. This is literally Genesis 3. You know, what does the serpent say to Adam and Eve? You know, he says, did God tell you can't eat any fruit? And she says, no, he told us that we can't eat of this one, you know, lest we die. And the very first thing he says is, you won't die.
Yeah.
And so him saying you won't die is denying sowing and reaping. He's saying you can sow these seeds and you won't have to deal with the consequences. So go ahead and talk about the connection between Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson and was it Machen?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So why don't you go ahead and cause that was fascinating to me as well.
There's a lot there. Cause he was actually, I think Machen kind of came from, he was born and raised in Baltimore, but he was a part of an elite sort of high society kind of family. His father was a lawyer in the area. His mother was a really faithful Christian, but they were actually family friends with Woodrow Wilson's family. Okay. So he knew Woodrow Wilson, I think from childhood. I'd have to check and see if that's, but I seem to remember reading that somewhere, but he certainly knew Woodrow Wilson in his later years in life when he was a professor at Princeton Seminary. Because when he was at Princeton Seminary, Woodrow Wilson was the president of Princeton University. So they actually attended. There's a church. It's still there. It's right on campus at Princeton. Right. It's sort of in between the university and the seminary. They're sort of right next door to each other. But there's a church that's right in the middle. And I believe Woodrow Wilson was either a deacon or maybe a ruling elder. In that church, and Machen was a teaching elder in that church. So they knew each other. And so he was very, very much aware of Woodrow Wilson, very much aware of the sort of social gospel stuff. And he knew him as a friend. And then what Wilson sort of became, he then later critiqued very heavily.
Wow. Okay.
So that connection is very, it's very interesting that he kind of was cued in to that.
100%. So do you happen to know offhand, like does he critique him in any books, or is it more articles and, you know, newspaper entries, or, you know, do you know offhand?
Yeah. So he critiques him. So there's a collection of articles that's called, Christianity, Education in the State. Or it might be Education, Christianity in the State. It's some combination of those three words.
Okay.
And it's a collection of articles, because usually when you see guys like Machen and the early Westminster founders talking about this stuff, it's usually in the realm of education.
Yeah.
Because they were educators and they were theologians. But what's interesting is, you know, you're not going to see much with Machen. You do see some actual like economic discussion.
Yeah.
But you're not going to see like an economic treatise coming out of these guys, because they're just not economists.
Exactly.
But what's really interesting is that they almost always will tie economics to education.
Yes.
And the reason I think that they do that, sort of maybe getting off topic of the question that you're asking.
No, go for it.
I think the reason they do that is because, well, one, of course, the education system in America is just one of complete government overreach.
100%.
And with central banking.
They're working in the university capacity as well, so it'd be fresh on their mind, and like they're living with those consequences.
But they also, I think they recognize that both government education and government money are both kind of designed to control the citizenry. So they're recognizing with education, it's particularly problematic for them because, you know, like Cornelius Van Til, he was very interested in education. He founded a Christian academy. I think it's a middle school and a high school that's in, it's right by Westminster Seminary. It's called the Philmont Christian Academy. Okay. And so he wrote about these things. Like I mentioned, he has a whole article critiquing John Dewey. And his basic argument is, if we have our kids that are sent off 5 days a week to be taught in a worldview that just completely divorces theology from life, and then we give them maybe an hour Sunday school and an hour in the church service, we're not going to be able to undo everything that they've been taught. And so whenever they talk about education and then they link education and economics, in my mind, I'm like, it's the same thing for them. They're recognizing that it's a way that the state can sort of control and create, you know, good little citizens because we've brainwashed you to be that way. And also we can cut off your money supply and
100%
you're destitute.
I would love to ask you a little bit more about your personal experience with, you know, with those relations, like the relationship between education and, I mean, again, you mentioned that you weren't able to go to Edinburgh just because of, you know, the cost of it and everything. That was one of the things that came up in the conversation with Doug as well, because New St. Andrews College, like, they don't accept any government funding. They refuse to put themselves in a position where they have to, you know, even if things look great now, there's no bad strings attached. Like, you're one fiat, you know, diktat away from having to change your entire business model to adapt to that. I'm trying to find this quote here while you were talking. Here it is. This is a Lewis quote, C.S. Lewis. He said, "I believe a man is happier and happy in a richer way if he has the freeborn mind. But I doubt whether he can have this without economic independence, which the new society is abolishing. For independence allows an education not controlled by government. And in adult life, it is the man who needs and asks nothing of government who can criticize its acts and snap his fingers at its ideology. Read Montaigne. That's the voice of a man with his legs under his own table, eating the mutton and turnips raised in his own land. Who will talk like that when the state is everyone's schoolmaster and employer?" And so I just think, I mean, like, you could just, I mean, they would have been peas in a pod. Machen and Lewis would have been, you know, heartily amening each other, it seems like. As fiat money trends towards zero, which it does in every single case, it gets more and more worthless over time. So those costs just continue to go up. And so education continues to go up, and it puts more and more pressure on people in decision-making capacities to make trade-offs. The relationship between money and education is enormous. When you think about how a lot of these cathedrals were built, you know, in the Enlightenment period, they had patrons, they had benefactors who had hard money, had storehouses of gold and silver, and that money was going up in value over time. Continue to grow in value versus value of that money degrading. And so the type of money you use impacts the consequences and impacts everything else that money touches. And so we see going to a Bitcoin standard will be a return to a hard money standard. And it would be a return to a lot of these similar types of, you know, secondary and tertiary consequences that having hard money. So let me, let me just ask you, as far as like your experience, what have you seen in that regard, in regards to the relationship between, you know, the government and education?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot there because I think I was just seeing that King's College in New York, which is they're probably going to be closing.
I can't believe it, man.
Just because the economics, it hardly makes sense. And you know, the same. There's some institutions, and it's institutions like Hillsdale. So Hillsdale, they don't accept government education loans, and they're doing very well right now. Grove City College is another one that's a specifically Christian one that doesn't do that, and I think that's probably going to be the way to go, because I think these government education loans are going to become more of a liability than they are
100%
asset. And right now, and I think with what we're seeing at King's, and then I think also Trinity International University is having a similar thing where they're cutting a bunch of their programs, a bunch of the residential programs, and doing mostly online stuff. I work at Westminster, and obviously I don't speak for Westminster or anything like that, but we've had to radically overhaul our whole business model in the last few years because of these issues. And you know, the economics of running an educational institution, especially a conservative Christian one, is tough. And the way that we were doing it for a long time, we were taking a hit on every student.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of this like this cycle where you take a hit on the student, and so you think, man, we're not doing well financially. We got to recruit more students. But when you recruit more students, you take more hits. So we had to completely overhaul our entire business model, and a lot of it was revolving around having, you know, basically patrons who help bankroll a lot of that the hit that we were taking. So, you know, it's kind of a scary world when you're relying on government money, because you know our mission at Westminster, at least, is to create pastors, create specialists in the Bible that are going to go out like old Princeton back when it was a cathedral or a bulwark, to you know, go out into the mission field, go be pastors. And so if we have the system of fiat currency of government money, once you have this huge upswing in inflation, now you have less students, now you have less ministers, now you have less preachers who are going out. So that, you know, the connection between fiat money and education and ministry, it's almost a straight line. So it's super important what you guys are doing with Bitcoin and hard money and sound money for the mission field, for the proclamation of the gospel.
100%. And like, honestly, like, again, because it's a weird, so it's just a really weird thing for a lot of people. I was a church planter and missionary in Montevideo, Uruguay for 7 years, from 2015 to just shy of the end of 2021. And that was part of the reason why Bitcoin clicked with me, was because, you know, we went to Uruguay to minister to largely secular Uruguayans. Like, Uruguay is this weird thing. It's like basically like a little chunk of quote unquote post-Christian Europe that you kind of just wedged on to South America. And so we went there thinking, you know, I was like a philosophy major, Bible major. We were thinking, you know, like more than almost half the country claims to be atheist or agnostic. And so I went with one thing in mind. And then when we get there, we arrive at the same time as a wave of 60,000 Venezuelan immigrants. And so, you know, we're seeing these people who were, in some cases, doctors, economists, who, you know, were making, in some cases, six figures in dollar-denominated terms a number of years prior, who, you know, over the course of 2 or 3, 4 years, they have to leave Venezuela to come to Uruguay. They left their families, and they, you know, in some cases, they weren't able to pay the rent some months. It's like death by a thousand cuts, and then you just absolutely collapse. So you get to the point where at the tail end of these fiat currency collapses, it's just not pretty, and there's very real consequences. And so again, that's part of our thing is trying to help people to see we're not exempt. We care about the nations. We care about God's name, you know, being proclaimed, and we invest. We put our money where our mouth is. And just the reality is that with every year that goes by, the people who are doing the most important work in the world, both here and around the world, are able to do less of it. This is not trying to be, we're not presenting Bitcoin or just sound money as like this panacea where everything is fixed if you just fix the money. But the sowing and reaping, the principle, God designed that to be this thing that you could bank on, generally speaking, and be blessed by him for doing it. So if I'm a good steward, I spend less than I produce. The expectation is that a godly man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And so, like, there is this expectation that parents will be able to, they'll have something to give to their families. And again, fiat currency basically brings that to an end. And then you have all these other kinds of perverse things that go along with it, like inheritance tax, that basically prioritize the existence and growth of the state at the expense of the base unit of economy, which is the family. You know, that's where it is, rather than just the state. the more that there's people like you helping to facilitate these kind of conversations, the better off the church is going to be for it. So, yeah, just really appreciate your time. Is there anything else that you'd like to mention to our audience?
I have one quote that I want to read because it's actually something that makes me appreciate you guys all the more in what you're doing.
Okay.
It's from R.B. Kuiper. He was one of the founders of Westminster. He was of that group, and he is actually one of the guys who speaks most about sort of social issues. And he had this to say in a article called "Hope of a Christian World Order," which is a great article. Actually, I tweeted through the entire thing on my Twitter account.
Well, I'll put the link in the show notes. That's awesome. I'm gonna
sure, sure. But he has this little section where he says, "Do we disparage the efforts of the statesman, the economist, the sociologist? Yes and no. If their statesmanship, their economics, their sociology be pagan, they cannot contribute to a Christian world order. But there is Christian statesmanship, Christian economics, Christian sociology. They are rooted in the gospel. Their exponents are specialists in the social implications of the gospel. They can contribute much. Today, they are few in number. May God raise up many more. The world needs them."
Amen. So,
may you guys raise up more Christian economists because the world needs them.
Amen. I really appreciate that. And we'll put that, again, we'll put a link to your Twitter account in the show notes. But let me just ask you, if there's some of our audience who's looking to maybe read some of these guys, some of these things from maybe, the last 100 years, like what's one book that you would recommend to them, something that you've found helpful?
Yeah. If you can get a copy, it might be out of print, but Machen's, there's probably used copies floating around. And I think most of it is available online just in like separate article format, but sure. Christianity Education in the State by Machen is a great one. It includes probably the funnest article in there is actually a transcription of him testifying before Congress against the formation of the Board of Education.
Yes.
So that's a fun one. He takes these congressmen to school. It's pretty great.
Oh, that's awesome. No, the reason why I'm laughing is because I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I'm going to run out right now before we publish this and try to grab a copy. So I'm feeling bad for all of the people who are probably listening to this right now who may or may not be able to get a copy of this. So hopefully.
Jordan got the last one. Very good.
Well, Brendan, I appreciate you, man. You have a great day.
Thanks. You too, man.